would not be willing or wanting to take on animal issues as well because of the historical connection that's been made as a way of perpetuating racism. And I'm always a bit confused and concerned about how do we approach that issue by saying, yes, there are links between different types of oppression without making people feel that they might be in some ways continuing on with a racist discourse. How do you respond to that, or how do you negotiate that?
Yeah, that's very tricky, and again, it's a great deal of sensitivity to that, and you're absolutely right. You know, other animals have been severely devalued and marginalized so that they're kind of seen as the lowest of the low, and if you've got societies that are still clinging to some, dark Darwinistic thoughts about, there being this hierarchy of humanity, and that those lesser individuals, or particularly those lesser groups among us, who are somehow less developed, then that's been used, for a long time to justify all kinds of oppression, from sexist oppression to oppression of folks, coming from different ethnic groups. So obviously there's going to be sensitivity to that, and a lot of activists, have gone out of their way, obviously, and even some scientists, to try to come up with scientific information to say, we are not, we're not animals, and we're as smart as the rest of you, of you more elite types.
Mm-hmm.
But then the problem is, once they think that they've made the case that all of humanity is essentially, we're all essentially equals intellectually with regards to our possibilities. Depending upon the times and the history and current events, somebody will always, come back with that old underlying message again. And most recently, was the bell curve, when scientists thought they'd laid to rest once and for all that they weren't inherent biological differences that made some members of the human species, lesser than others, then, the whole idea is dusted off and it comes back again. And I'm convinced that card will be played over and over again until those of us who are struggling against oppression and injustice step back and say, this is not the way to go or to promote justice for any oppressed group, and we need to go back and challenge that hierarchy from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
Because as long as you have a hierarchy of life and a hierarchy of worth, and you're going to see some existing and so low a status as to justify some form of exploitation, it's always going to be a short step, to turn that to other devalued groups. So it becomes a tricky step for activists, but as long as activists, continue, to take the less difficult path and they try to get around that issue, it's kind of like, it may seem like it's a step forward, but it comes back to pull them back in the long run.
Mm-hmm. I started getting interested in animal issues when I was doing some women's studies. I was doing my women's studies degree at the University of Manitoba, and I was so inspired by the set of frameworks that we were given to work with in terms of analyzing oppression and this idea that all oppressions are related and that you couldn't sort of divorce one oppression from others and that they reinforce each other, that they help define each other, made total sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, I started reading about factory farms and animal experimentation labs and all these different sorts of things, and I was horrified, and I thought, oh, well, I've got this framework that says all oppressions are linked. We just need to add on the animal piece, or we just need to add on the environmental piece. This framework can still work.
Right.
And I was really surprised, and this is not true right across the board, but I was surprised by some of my colleagues who were extremely resistant to incorporating sort of an animal perspective or thinking about animals as well. And I found it really alienating, and I was trying to understand, well, where does this resistance come from? And I think that, as you were saying before, that, historically, marginalized groups, one of the ways that they have been marginalized is through this comparison with with animals. It would make perfect sense that people would want to distance themselves from incorporating, looking at animals or somehow aligning themselves with animals to say that I've been oppressed, this animal's oppressed, puts us in a kind of the same camp. And there was just this recognition that almost the animal's oppression doesn't exist, because if animal oppression existed, we'd have to incorporate it into our framework. Our framework cannot accommodate this new type of suffering. So I just I thought that was interesting, and so I started looking at ecofeminist scholarship, and this is something I wanted to ask you about, because there has been some work out there by ecofeminists who have made that willing comparison between animals and women, and looking at how they've sort of been jointly oppressed and exploited. And I'm just curious how you feel that your piece, this book, for example, contribute to the conversation. Does it build upon, does it stretch that discourse, that scholarship that's already out there, or what new piece does your book offer?
Yeah, well, I kind of moved down the same path that you did, and also for me, ecofeminism has, I think it's a very valuable and important part of the scientific literature and theoretical thought, and for me, you know, was instrumental in helping me, you know, to make that step, towards looking at the entanglement of these oppressions. So, you know, I'm deeply indebted to the work of people like Carol Adams and Josephine Donovan and others, you know, who have move the discourse. As a sociologist, you know, I sat down to, you know, to give thought to what I had to contribute to that. And when I looked at the animal rights movement in general, one of the things that I saw as somewhat problematic, or something that was perhaps holding the movement back a bit, was in the last analysis the theoretical framework or the cause of oppression seemed merely to suggest that it was prejudice against other animals, and/or it was due to ethical short-sightedness, and that each of us as an individual needed to step up and think about what we were doing and about the impact it had on the lives of other animals. I think ecofeminism came back and basically suggested, you know, there are deep ideological connections, you know, that support the oppression of humans and other animals. In Carol Adams' book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, you did an outstanding job of looking at those ideological connections between sexism and speciesism. And being trained as a sociologist and having a specialization in racial and ethnic groups, I was familiar enough with the literature to realize that for many scholars, you know, looking at the racial and ethnic oppression, ideology is seen as a tool. So the ideology is not the motivating force. That ideology tends to, you bring it in when you need rationalization or justification for oppression. And for many scholars, particularly coming from conflict or critical-oriented schools of thought of racial and ethnic oppression, one of the primary factors in most cases, generally speaking, is going to be it's in a more powerful group. It's in their material or economic interest, you know, to oppress members of another ethnic group. And then once that, you know, once you begin oppressing them and it's in your material economic interest, then you need both the power to keep them oppressed, but you also need to rationalize it, both for yourself and members of your community, and you also try to sell that justification to the oppressed group themselves. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying I thought that I could, you know, add some additional theoretical thought, you know, to this emerging consciousness and body of literature by suggesting perhaps the root cause in many cases of oppression of both humans and other animals is economic or material gain, and then once that primary motivating factor is there, then we can look at speciesism and see that not only not really as prejudice or ethical short-sightedness, but seeing it as being part of a larger ideological framework that is used to explain, justify, rationalize that mistreatment of other groups. So I guess I was attempting to kind of expand the theoretical framework and to add to the ecofeminist literature in that way.
Right. So that would make sense then, given given your perspective, that you know, you look at agriculture as sort of being this moment of where things kind of sort of jumped up and there was this intensification that happened. And it resulted in, you know, this these various different types of oppression becoming perhaps even more intensified or continued. And then, you know, if we look at the rise of capitalism, which I wanted to talk about after the break, that would make sense that the rise of industrialization, the rise of Fordism would also impact this economic-based oppression, and that the formation of the ideology as well as how it would be used. And that I would also say that globalization now, too, as a different element, sort of this transnational capitalism. And these are some of the ideas that I'd like to come back and talk about after the break. We've been speaking with David Nybert, who wrote, Wendy was saying I should say this on the air, wrote the book I Wish I Could Have Written. It's just, I think, a fantastic collection of various different analyses. I think that your, hopefully we can talk about this in this part of the interview, that your analysis of capitalism and how it relates to oppression is just so incredibly important. So the book is called Animal Rights, Human Rights, Entanglements of Oppression and Liberation, written by David Nybert, who is on the line right now. David, could you give us a sense of how capitalism has impacted or influenced human and animal oppression?
Yeah, it's in many ways has made it so much worse. Obviously, one of the points I point out in the book is that the oppression of human and other animals, you know, it certainly preceded the development of capitalism. And yeah, and to be candid and to be kind of autobiographical for a moment, you know, when I was schooled here in the United States and I was taught that, you know, industrialization was a huge step forward for humanity and everything was progress and everything is going up, up and up and getting better and better. And I believed that for a long time, but then as I began to look around and become more hip to what was going on both in the United States and around the world, and reading reports, for example, from the United Nations that would say, you know, the levels of hunger, malnutrition around the globe, you know, are increasing, and levels of disparity have increased at such levels in the past couple decades that they're now grotesque. And then the animal advocate in me, you know, sees the number of animals, you know, simply in agribusiness that are living this horrible brief existence and then going into these horrible processes of slaughter, go from thousands to millions to billions. And then you begin to realize that, you know, that capitalism is a very problematic set of structural, political, and economic arrangements, you know, both for our species and all others as well.
Yeah, I'm glad that you raised that point, too, about how I don't think that the argument that you're making, it's obvious that you're not making that, you know, capitalism somehow caused speciesism. But I think sometimes my experience with activists who are reluctant to look at this sort of how capitalism has influenced animal oppression, for example, is that somehow if you're looking at economics, as it's not as if we got rid of capitalism that everything would be okay. And I think sometimes there's that sort of misinterpretation that if you're bringing that into the analysis that you're saying, you know, it's the central key instead of saying it had an impact and it had a very important impact. You said, you know, that it's probably stepped it up. It's made it worse. How has capitalism actually impacted animal oppression then in some concrete ways?
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, with you know, what goes on in the scientific community, and a lot of it, in my sense, you know, from where I'm looking at it, is quasi-science or even pseudoscience. You know, but there's been, you know, a tremendous increase in the use of animals, you know, in research labs. And there have been efforts by, you know, animal activists, you know, to try to step back on that and, you know, to move for, you know, reduction and replacement where possible. But still, you know, the equating of progress and capitalist development, you know, with science and huge industries like the pharmaceutical industry, for example, and a biomedical industry, you know, they've got they've relied on increasing uses of other animals. In some cases, you know, when their experimentation on other animals, you know, proves something that helped them to promote a product, that'll be, you know, touted out before the public. And then if they run across something that shows that their product somehow injured other animals, mm-hmm. then they reassess, they don't disclose it. So there's a whole lot of hypocrisy that goes on there. But, you know, perhaps, you know, the most horrific and important example has to do with, you know, this growing giant of agribusiness and how most of the other animals on the planet, you know, who experience, you know, unspeakable acts by members of our species are those who are in the socially created position of farm animals.
Mm.
And like I said earlier, you know, the numbers of those persons who are subjected, you know, to that horrendous treatment, you know, now numbers just in the U.S. alone, you know, in the billions every
mm-hmm.
year.
In Canada, it's 640 million for food animals, so-called food animals, every year.
Mm.
Yeah, the numbers are just completely astounding. And I think now, especially with globalization, transnational capitalism, that it's becoming, I think it's already a very terrifying and horrible situation, but it's becoming increasingly so as the markets continually push out further and further into the globe to find new areas to exploit. And that one of the ways that I think the meat industry has been gaining a lot of power is to sell meat as a way of developing. So you can go to a so-called developing country and say, you know, if you want to be affluent, if you want to be westernized, if you want prosperity, then you should eat meat and you should use our techniques. And so you can really start to see how globalization as an economic process has these sort of very concrete material ramifications for animals, and the numbers are just growing. And as someone who, you know, is a vegetarian or vegan, you can start feeling like your little protest, your sort of individual protest that you do each day doesn't mean a lot in sort of the face of these numbers. But sort of an understanding of globalization can really understand how these numbers are getting so much bigger. So anyway, I just kind of wanted to add that to as a piece onto capitalism, this discussion of capitalism as well, and to see if you had, what in the book, how do you incorporate sort of analysis of globalization or transnationalism? Do you look at that issue at all?
Yeah, I think that is one of the key issues of the times right now, you know, and outside of impending warfare, you know, perhaps, you know, the most crucial issue, but really, you know, the impending warfare of the U.S., you know, the Bush administration, you know, trying to rally international support and national support for the war against Iraq can't really be separated out, you know, from this continuing movement toward globalization. And, you know, powerful corporations and the elite class of the world continuing to try to rig the system so that those, you know, they already have most of what there is to get, and they're trying to get more. And they do that, you know, by continuing to use, you know, both humans and other animals as fodder, you know, for the increased accumulation of profit. And globalization, you know, takes it in so many different directions. here within the United States to keep meat, you know, which is a euphemism for animal flesh, to continue to make that affordable to the masses, which in part is something of an opiate. If even if the poorest, you know, are able to afford a burger or an inexpensive piece of meat, they feel some sense of well-being. But in order to keep that on their plates, for decades, you know, the U.S. and other countries have been reaching into other parts of the world, you know, under the auspices of globalization and utilizing such elitist financial institutions as the World Bank and the IMF, you know, to open up various countries and to contribute to the destruction of forests and to the driving of subsistence farmers off the soil. And in Brazil, for example, leading to the destruction of lives of rubber tappers and their families. And, you know, the whole development of global capitalism it's not creating a better world. It's been very destructive in the environment, and clearly, you know, just a few weeks ago, that some in South Africa, you know, everyone is agreeing that, you know, this we can't continue in this direction. But the elite countries of the world, who are kind of in the grip of some very powerful corporations and individuals, are reluctant, you know, to take the steps necessary to clean that up. So globalization is, I guess, one of the other awful aspects of it, and this brings in the World Trade Organization, is even when countries do step up and they try to create regulations to protect their workforce, to protect their environment, to protect animals,
mm-hmm.
Now those very regulations can be set aside and penalized as being obstacles to free trade.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that democracy exists around the world, it is going to be, you know, set back even further, you know, with the advent of globalization, the WTO, and it just spells, you know, further tragedy, you know, for members of all species.
Mm-hmm. These are huge, huge issues, and I know when, from my own research, just trying to understand agribusiness and different ways that I could imagine intervening in this tremendously powerful system, that sometimes I wonder, you know, for example, if Marxist or socialist theories that have, you know, put capitalism, put economics at the center of their analyses, if they could be useful when we're looking at the sort of intermingling that you were talking about. Could Marxism, for example, or socialist theories be useful for intervening, for making sense of sort of the intermingling of oppression that's happening, the non-human animal oppression?
Yes and no. I think it depends on how it's used. I think, you know, by analogy, the same could be said about, you know, sociological theory. You know, sociology, as I was taught it, you know, was the study of the human species and other animals, you know, were just kind of there as fodder, considered a natural resource. And the discipline of sociology just focused in on, you know, what's happening with members of our species. And so I think sociology can be tremendously useful, but there needs to... We need to develop a new paradigm in which sociology is a study of all groups on the planet,
mm-hmm.
and their social systems and the social orders they exist in. So I think if sociology would take that track, I think it would be a tremendous step forward, both for the discipline and its and for the improvement, you know, for all around the world. So, and I think Marxist and socialist literature, I kind of see it in the same regard. If you're going to consider it in kind of, say, orthodox Marxism is not too friendly to other animals, and even Marx himself, you know, made this distinction between humans and other animals,
mm-hmm.
and how capitalism are making humans like animals, and,
right.
And we need to, you know, we need to stop that. So, you know, as much as I consider Marx a mentor from afar, I think that Marx is speciesist, and that there's a whole lot to be learned both from Marx and other leftist scholars and socialists But I think, you know, there again, you know, we need to glean, you know, what can we learn about oppression, about the economic basis of oppression, how the state is used to maintain it, and how the ideology is created and mustered to protect it. But if we get too mirrored in some of the, if we treat it as dogma and we try to become orthodox, that I fear that a lot of it is also very speciesist in nature, and it won't get us very far. So we have to approach it, I think, with new eyes, new insights, and look, you know, taking it in different directions.
Right. We don't have very much time left, and there's so many more questions that I'd like to ask you. I wanted to talk about this idea of the United struggle against oppression. I don't think we're going to get a chance to talk about the what next question that always arises after our shows, that, you know, what do you do? How do you try to create some kind of change or intervention? But maybe if you could just leave us with a few words in the next minute or so, how you'd like to end the interview, if you wanted to talk about maybe some things that people could do or different ways to give us to think about coalition building or anything like that, that would be great.
Yeah, well, I guess the way that I end my book and what I try to get the folks to think about, particularly folks in the movements for social justice, is I think it would be a major step forward, you know, for progressives of all stripes and activists, you know, if we could, you know, look to build, you know, sustained coalitions that take us, you know, from, you know, just coming together at rallies and demonstrations, you know, to much deeper strategizing. And particularly, I think the animal rights movement has lots of resources, you know, to lend to the overall movement of justice. And I believe that folks, progressive and folks on the left, you know, need to have their eyes open to that. Plus, animal rights activists need to reconsider, you know, their loyalty to a system, a capitalist system, that, you know, that heaps so much oppression upon other animals.
Mm-hmm. David, thank you so much for being on the show today.
I was very happy to do it.
We appreciate it. Hopefully we'll even get you on maybe at a different time to continue on the conversation. It's extremely important work that you're doing, and I commend you for it. Again, the book is called Animal Rights, Human Rights, Entanglements of Oppression and Liberation. We've been speaking with David Nybert.